Light Warrior Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Kann, author of the number one bestseller, Sensitivity is Your Superpower, How to Harness Your Gifts, Fulfill Your Purpose, and Create a Life of Joy. And if you're new to my tribe, I'd love to give you my free gift, The Sensitive Soul Empowerment Guide, the three ways of navigating your way to more peace, positivity, and personal power. And you can get that at SensitiveSoulGuide.com. So SensitiveSoulGuide.com, all one word. You can get a free PDF, and we hope that you join our community as well, which is the Light Medicine Community, and we'll share with you how to do all of that once you get your free gift. Now, today I'm super excited because I have with me here Dr. Kevin Krenitsky, and he was actually a family medicine doctor, and his book, The Still Point, was gifted to me. Just kind of showed up, you know, on my doorstep one day, and I'm like, huh, wonder who gave this to me. I think it was the publishers, but they're very smart because this is exactly what I've been talking about and sharing for quite some time in my own Dr. Karen Kann way. And I love when I read other things that really resonate and say it differently, complimentary to what I'm saying. And what I really love about Dr. Kevin's book here, The Still Point, is that it's in the kind of a Q&A format, and that makes it really highly accessible. And so many of the quote-unquote questions that are in here were questions that I had or have, and the answers I thought were profound. And in fact, I didn't tell Dr. Kevin this before we went and recorded this show, but there were times where I was like, okay, let's see what this guy's really made of. Let's see some of these questions, okay? Let's see if he goes into judgment. And you know what? He didn't. I was like, wow, he's the real deal. So I got to get him on the show. So let me read you a little bit about what we're going to be talking about today and Dr. Krenitsky's bio. So we're going to be talking about recognizing and living as our true nature. So we're going to be discussing the book, The Still Point, The Simplicity of Spiritual Enlightenment. Most people are living lives with varying degrees of stress or unease. Sometimes it's little, but sometimes it can be really big, depending on what's going on in the outside world for many people. And then Dr. Kevin, you know, saying, wow, even though all these symptoms are due to seemingly other things, there is one false underlying belief, namely that we are separate, isolated individuals, unconnected to others or the world around us. So in the book, he leads us directly back to the recognition of our true nature, and that is of being shared with all sentient creatures and its inherent qualities of peace, happiness, and self. And so the teaching has been called perennial philosophy because it's the core message of all great spiritual traditions throughout the ages. And unfortunately, well, the way it is right now is that the realization has been overlooked by society as a whole, and that has led to, as many of us sensitive souls know and are here to help heal the planet, it has led to, you know, war and famine and dis-ease, and really not the kind of thing that we grew up wanting, right? The joy, the peace, the harmony. And so many of us in this sensitive soul tribe are so wanting to create that world, that ideal future reality where we are all at peace. I believe it's possible in the bones of my body. I know that it's possible, and I know it's possible in my lifetime. I don't know how I know that, but I just feel it. So I think that this book is really important for us to, again, have some feedback, some sense of where, you know, people go, oh, I want enlightenment, I got to do all this meditation, I got to, no, I don't have time. Well, guess what? You don't have to do it that way. So Dr. Krenitsky has been a medical doctor like myself, also a professional rock musician, a business executive. And despite leading a life deemed outwardly successful, he lived with a deep background of anxiety, fear, and stress that waxed and waned since early childhood. And at the age of 40, in the midst of decades of suppressing tremendous inner and outer conflict, I don't know what that's like, totally know what that's like, he reasoned there must be another way. So his willingness led to a decade of studying non-duality by the way of A Course in Miracles. Later, at the height of a successful business career, he turned away into relative isolation and soon found the direct path to the recognition of our true nature. One day in meditation, a thought came that a book called The Still Point would be written. So 5 years later, here it is. Dr. Krenitsky, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, Dr. Karen, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. So So Kevin, I think your the background's kind of interesting. Medical doctor, rock musician, like how does that lead to studying A Course in Miracles?
Yeah, suffering is really, you know, suffering is the word. And as I kind of mentioned, and you kind of read about there, I was just really chugging along and doing what we all do to try to find happiness. And we do what the world tells us to do. You know, we try to obtain great jobs, great romantic partnerships, you know, money, position, and all of that. And I was doing that. And, you know, according to the eyes of the world, it was going really well. But it wasn't going so well for me. You know, I was anxious since I was a little kid, off and on, and sometimes very, very severely. You know, I think right after medical school started taking anti-anxiety medicine, which I was on for, you know, 25 or 26 years or something along those lines. Yeah. And, you know, conflicts within relationships and whatnot. So it was just an exhaustion. It was a complete failure, really, you know, and this great paradox of looking out and seeing how everybody would say, wow, you're doing great. And, you know, not feeling that way at all. as things often happen, A Course in Miracles, you know, kind of showed up, and that was really the first very, very, very deep foray into this, and then it led to some of the other things I talked about.
Well, and just to clarify, thank you for saying all that. Just to clarify for our listeners as well, the still point is not a regurgitation of the A Course in Miracles at all, at least in you know, my perception of it, and it. Honestly, Kevin, I did not finish reading A Course in Miracles. I mean, there were some parts that totally didn't resonate with me. Maybe it was the languaging. You know, it felt kind of religious in some aspects. And I was healing some past religious programming, so I think some of that just didn't resonate with me at the time. So I'm really glad for your book because then I can come full circle with some of that and understand it deeper. So tell me a bit about that experience for you.
Yeah, that's very true. A Course in Miracles is a beautiful work. It's a psycho-spiritual work, beautiful work in non-duality. But it is, as you stated, it is a work that's written in, you know, very much Judeo-Christian language. And you know, it serves a tremendous purpose for those who kind of perhaps were really conditioned by religion, you know, and need to unwind their mind from that a little bit. And that was very helpful for me. And if it resonates for folks, they usually know it very quickly, and they should, you know, they should then do it and pursue it. But if it doesn't, it, you know, it doesn't. And it did resonate for me, and I took it really as far as I could take it. But it wasn't all coming together for me. And that's when I came upon this direct path. And the direct path is really what the still point is about. And this is really where we go directly to our true nature of aware being. We recognize that, and we then go from there. So, yes, it's very different in its approach and its writing than The Course in Miracles is. A Course in Miracles deals with the ego mind, the mind that believes it's separate, and beautifully, you know, begins to unwind that mind. But the direct path, it goes directly towards our true unchanging nature and moves from there. So, yeah, that's kind of the distinction between them.
Okay, yes, thank you for explaining that. Now, before we get to the how piece, because I know people are anxiously awaiting this piece, I want to give a little bit of background and color kind of our conversation and what people have experienced, what I've experienced in the past, things that have worked and that hasn't worked, but definitely things that haven't worked. Let's talk about that first. So talk to us about religion. So religion, where is it failing us? Where is it helpful? And why is it that so many, there was, when I first came to the small town in U.S., I hadn't seen so many churches in my life. There's like churches everywhere. But yet, you know, it's like people are still struggling. Why is that? And you know, what benefits are there to religion versus something else?
Yeah, I mean, you know, religion as it is currently practiced is directly in duality. In other words, you know, many of the approaches are in religion are having you appeal to a power, a god, a god, a lord, whatever it is, that's outside of you, and essentially, appealing to that god for peace, for happiness. Whereas the reality is that we, and this is the perennial philosophy, is that, we have to go within. We have to find the core of our own being. So that, that simple difference is very, very significant for many of us. And that's predominantly why religion, being really firmly rooted in duality, isn't able to take us to our true nature. And that's the only place that we can ever find the peace and the happiness that we're all craving. Mm. It's true that the grace, that impetus that we have to be devotional and to worship, it all comes from the same place. It all comes from our aware being. It's, a pull of ourselves back to ourselves. But at some point we have to take this kind of inward path where we stop relying on an external figure or being, and we begin to go within. And truly, as even in the Bible, as Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within. And these are very, very powerful and true words. So that's kind of the major difference, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Beautifully said. The duality piece, can you, just for people that are pretty new to this idea, what's the difference between duality, polarity, and unity consciousness or thinking, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think, most humans, most people on this planet, most people believe and feel that they are separate, isolated beings. They're separate, isolated individuals, that there's a them that's inside, and their thoughts and feelings are their thoughts and feelings inside, and there's some border, the body is kind of the border of the skin, and then outside of this we have the world, which is other, and which is not us. And it leads immediately to fear. It leads immediately to guilt. This idea of being separate in a world that is very foreign, very foreign to us. This is kind of the dualistic perspective, and it's the perspective, you can also call it the materialist perspective, if people aren't as much into, the religious or the spiritual kind of language. It's the materialist perspective, in that our consciousness is produced by the brain, and when the body and the brain dies, that consciousness dies. Whereas non-duality is this recognition that consciousness or being is whole, it's shared, meaning that my being and your being are the same. The being that looks out of our eyes, so to speak, or any other sentient creature's eyes, is the same being. It's whole and it's complete. And the body is simply a vehicle. It's a vehicle within that consciousness, as is all experience, all thoughts, all feelings, all sensations. So this recognition relieves that fear and that guilt of separation. It takes away the two primal fears of man, that we can really take any fear that we have and take it back to either the fear of extinction or death, or the fear of lack. And when we see that our being is whole and complete, it was not created, it doesn't come and doesn't go, the fear of death is eliminated. And again, because it's whole and complete, that fear of lack is eliminated as well. And as a result of that, we're able to live freely within that realization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Got it. And one of the things I really resonated with in the book was the thought about, how do we heal this world? Now, a lot of people have that want. And in fact, despite the polarity, the left versus right, the blue, red, blah, 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 white hat, black hat, all that kind of stuff, we all want the same thing in general, with very few exceptions, is we all want to be able to love, to live, to be free, to enjoy our lives. So it doesn't really matter what our other beliefs are, whether we're Judeo-Christian or Muslim or whatever. So a lot of folks now are saying, well, you know, there are these evil people, you know, in the world,
yeah,
and we need to get rid of the evil people so that we can be free. So this is like the freedom fighting movement. And right,
yeah,
now, at currently in where I am in consciousness, when I hear the word fight, I'm going to fight for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to fight for freedom. I kind of cringe, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm just like not there. I was, though. I was. Kevin, I was totally like, you know, even some of the past words we use, like the battle of good and evil, right?
Yeah.
Or the battle within,
yeah,
ourselves. So tell us about how can we create a harmonious, joyful world and not necessarily fight against what we consider so-called evil or bad or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I see it as well. You know, I'm attuned to the movement that's happening in the world, and now we have this idea of trying to displace the problem from us, and the only place it can be solved is within us individually. You know, to displacing it on outside people, and we blame it on, you know, this group, that group, the elites. You know, so all these things, and you know, these are just incredibly tricky mechanisms of the ego mind that is continually trying to say either suppress the problem or displace it on somebody else, project it onto someone else, or, you know, whether it's a being, another, a group, person, situations. We can solve, the only thing that we can solve, the only thing that we can do is to fix our problems ourselves individually. We can recognize the truth that we are. And that in and of itself, because when you recognize the truth in yourself as the being of everyone, you do in fact free the world. You free the constrictive idea of duality and of separation. And that in and of itself is the greatest gift that you can give to the world. It doesn't mean that actions won't flow from that. It doesn't mean that, you know, things will not happen after that. Of course they will, but when we lead with the idea of trying to change the world without changing our own minds, which is the only thing we actually can do, then we will forever be frustrated. It is impossible, you know, to do that. There was a great quote by one of the kind of great spiritual sages that a lot of people know, Ramana Maharshi, from, you know, the last or early part of last century, where, you know, when he talks about changing the world, he talks about it like trying to put a carpet of leather all around the world to prevent you from walking on, you know, rocks and stones. When he says all you have to do is put shoes on your own feet, you know, so don't try to change the world. Change yourself. Change the way you view and you feel, you know, change your approach to the world by recognizing your unity. Because that unity is the unity of all. And I say it in the book a lot. It's a revolution of one. And that's really all. The only one we can be responsible for is ourselves.
Absolutely. I totally resonate with that. And what it makes me think of the whole debate now, which I'm actually happy to see online, the germ theory versus the train theory, right? So in medical school, we were taught, hey, these microbes cause disease. And you got to kill them with antibiotics. And so that's the germ theory, thanks to Louis Pasteur and whoever else was funding him. And the second piece is the terrain theory. So in other words, disease does not happen in someone whose terrain, whose foundations are strong. You can, you know, try to, you know, give them a disease, but it doesn't catch very, very easily. So it's sort of like what you're saying is that if each of us, because some people will look and say, Kevin, I don't know, there's like billions of people on the planet. How can I make a difference, right? But I'm thinking if each of us are considered like a cell in the huge body of humanity, each cell reverts to its most pristine, optimal, functioning, healthy state, then eventually that terrain will become healthier and healthier and healthier. And instead of trying to kill the germ or the bad guys, it will naturally just be displaced from our reality.
Right. Yeah, I think that, you know, to take the reality that all we can do, it's a revolution of one, all we can do is change our own minds and recognize our being, as the unified being of all. When we do that, in a sense, when enough beings do that, then it's inevitable the outside will change. It is inevitable. But the real reality of it is that at that point, if you have gotten to the point where you are accepting what is, you are saying yes to what is, then that no longer becomes a concern. It isn't a concern because you recognize that your only job is to accept the experience that you're having and accept it completely without resisting it, without pushing away. Otherwise, you're right back into unhappiness and you're not at peace if you're in resistance to what is. So yeah.
Yes, and that was one of my favorite parts on page 32. Suffering is resistance to whatever one is experiencing in the moment. There can't be suffering without resistance. So I love that line. It's just so well said, because every day we can be in resistance to some degree, and we have that opportunity to release that resistance, to just be able to, quote unquote, love whatever's happening to us, even if we just stubbed our toe and it hurts.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yep. Yeah, every day we get to have the opportunity to do this work, one person can make a big difference. So, at least in my experience, I'm sure you've felt very similarly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, we recognize our true nature, and when we recognize our true nature, we recognize it as the true nature of all, and it releases. It releases every mind, if you will, in that regard. And you know, from that point forward, it's where that leads is this recognition or this realignment of the way you live, the way you think, the way you feel, the way you act and interact with others, in accordance with this. You know, and that's a process that is ongoing. That I don't think has an end, and it goes on after this recognition. But it is fundamentally different because it takes place within the peace and the happiness of your true nature. It's no longer that journey to peace. It's that journey in peace. In peace after that.
Oh, yes, yes. I love that. And what I've noticed, too, is there are really, going back to, you know, the whole fight thing for a moment, there is definitely a lot of positive movements out there that are trying to make a difference. Some of them, you know, are using the fight energy, which is less than optimal in terms of, you know, results. But others are taking action, whether that be, you know, dismantling old systems or creating new ones and things like that. And my sense is that if consciousness or, you know, connecting to our true nature is not at the foundation of those actions, then those actions may manifest some struggles or some difficulty. What's your thoughts on
yeah.
that? The action
yeah,
before
beautiful.
The consciousness.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, no, you know, that one of the great quotes ever was this quote by the Christian mystic Saint Augustine, I think in the third century, where he said, "Love and do what you will," and that is saying love, meaning know yourself, recognize your being as the plenary reality and the reality of all, and that we are not separate. That our aware being is the very same, and from that recognition, from that understanding, then let action flow. Then the actions that flow from that will be in alignment with that, and they will be beneficial to the entire ecosystem and not a separate, isolated individual. So, yeah, I think that's beautiful, Dr. Taryn.
Yeah, thank you. So how does one become enlightened, if you will, or come to our true nature? Because people are like, okay, this is great, Dr. Kevin, but what's the how? How do I get there?
Yeah.
How do I work on myself?
Yeah, I mean, right. And I think that, you know, we can't become what we already are, what we already always are. Our being, our aware being, is always always present. We are always present. We are always aware. And if we go through our experience, we can note that. I mean, there are times when the mind will, you know, will throw up things like, well, deep sleep, I'm not aware in deep sleep. Well, there's nothing to be aware of, but you're aware of yourself. Because when you wake up in the morning and somebody said, how did you sleep? Well, if you slept deeply, you say, great, I slept great. It was wonderful. So we do know it. You know, it doesn't go away. And the practice, which is really the, I think the reason the skill point was written, the practice is really at that very core initial recognition of just saying, look, we have been conditioned to continually look for ourselves and for the answers in experience, in thoughts, in doing, in emotions and feeling and all of this. When we need to go prior to all experience, we need to go prior to the mind and recognize that aspect of ourselves that is aware of thoughts, aware of feelings, aware of sensations, aware of all of that. And this simple practice of sitting and asking the question, am I aware? When you ask that question, it bypasses the mind. And we recognize that we're aware. We recognize that awareness. We don't recognize that intellectually. We recognize that in the same way that if you stepped on your dog's paw, the dog would yelp. It's a known recognition that we are aware. And from that point, we then begin to give that aspect more and more of our attention. We release our attention from everything that comes and goes, all of the experience of our lives, and we rest and abide as that awareness. And over time, that awareness moves more into the forefront of our experience, if you will, than being in the background of our experience. And our identity. Yeah, so this, the first thing that has to be said about enlightenment or liberation or self-recognition is that it isn't an experience, and we are continually focused on our experience. In other words, we've been conditioned to give all of our attention to our thoughts and our feelings and what we see and hear and feel and the way that we conceptualize it all with thoughts. So the trick, if you will, is to simply relax into the recognition of that aspect of our experience that knows all that comes and goes. And the way in the book that, and I think it's kind of the main purpose of the book, is really to just get people to simply ask themselves, am I aware? And when they ask themselves that question, it bypasses the mind. This is the essence of the direct path. It bypasses the mind, and they recognize, they go to, if you will, that recognition of their self-aware being. And when we do that, this is not something that we recognize intellectually. It's not something that we recognize through thought. It's recognized in the way that if you step on your dog's paw, your cat's tail, they'll yelp. It's known in that way. When we know that, when we recognize that, we can begin to give our attention to that as opposed to everything that comes and goes, which is all of our experience, our thoughts, our emotions are constantly coming and going. And in time, we begin to shift our identity as we spend more and more time abiding as that simple sense of aware being that we are. We recognize this is what I've called I my entire life. When I say I did this, I did this, I thought this, I went here, the I is this non-changing being, this felt sense of I am. And over time, the identity begins to shift from the belief that we are this conditioned entity, you know, the personality and all of the conditioning that we've received and the body, you know, that the body is our actual identity as opposed to being an experience, a vehicle within consciousness. We recognize that consciousness, that awareness is what I am. It's my actual being. And with time, as we abide there more and more, we its properties begin to reveal themselves to us, meaning that it doesn't come and go. It's you can call that eternal. It isn't something that wasn't born. It can't die. Meaning what you are wasn't born. What you are can't die. It's full. It's complete. It has no borders. It's infinite in that regard. And that sense of lack then also begins to diminish with that. And when those properties are clearly seen, this is what's been commonly called salvation or liberation or enlightenment. And it's simply this initial withdrawal of focus, really, from all that comes and goes to that being, to our recognition of self, and abiding there more and more and over again. That's how it happens for most people.
Oh, that's neat. I noticed of recent that in the past, I just was not into meditation because I think I was supposed to go somewhere. And It frustrated me being so active in my mind and always creating in my mind. And so for me, I had to go through the body and just if I was fearful, one of my favorite stories, Kevin, is I was watching a scary movie and I couldn't sleep the first time I watched it. And then I had to watch the sequel. So when I watched the sequel, I thought, well, guess what? Meditation didn't work. Doing toning didn't work. Doing progressive relaxation didn't work. Doing self-hypnosis didn't work. You know, nothing was yoga. Nothing worked, right? And I just was like not sleeping for 3 days. So I thought, you know, I'm just going to freaking be scared. I'm just going to be scared, right? So I was seeing the scenes in my mind. It was making me scared. So then I thought I went into the body. And then it seemed like a light switch went on. All of a sudden, I felt my heart pounding out of my chest. I thought the bed was moving. It was so intense. All this energy coursing up and down my body and to the limbs. I felt like lightning was shooting out of my toes and fingers. And I was so interested in, oh, well, that's interesting. I didn't notice this a minute ago, you know, that I fell asleep. The fear got turned into transmuted somehow, just being aware of that, like I'm just being in it. So that's the start of my journey into what I call the stillness, is not worrying so much about trying to get somewhere.
It's true. This is very, what you just described is very much this tantric approach, which is I talk about in the book extensively. And that is this, the moment we stop turning away from our fear, you know, and we begin to decouple the sensations and the thoughts, then we have a great opportunity, which is what you realized. And that's, you know, when fear arises in us, we there is a sensation and in the body, and it's a vibration within the field of awareness. It can certainly include the heart pounding, as you mentioned, and all these, you know, all these other kind of vibrate, but it is just a vibration. It is thought that comes in and joins itself to that that raw sensation, and it creates this emotion that can turn into panic in the mind. When we recognize that we can sit with the raw sensation alone, and we can put the fear aside, we can put the thoughts aside, we can sit with those sensations and give them great attention. We can bring them so close. We can bring them very, very close and be very interested in them. And we can get to the point where we can say, yeah, I can completely live with this. This is this actual sensation without the thoughts on top of it. There may be an intensity to it, but it's neutral. It's a neutral. It's not, it doesn't even raise itself to the level of pain, you know, of bodily pain. And that acceptance of that is that initial seed, that seed of acceptance is, as you said, very often what happens is then it's kind of like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, like you're pulling the curtain aside and you're really seeing that there's nothing really that's scary here. The mind came in and tried to create this huge issue with adding thought to these sensations, but these are really just neutral sensations, and I can accept them and live with them and not resist them right now. And that's really opening to the underlying peace, the underlying awareness that's that is behind any of those sensations. So yeah, it's a beautiful description.
Oh, and it was a very, very liberating indeed. In fact, some of my newer students, a couple of them, they're highly, highly empathic and sensitive, were like, oh, I have all this buzzing and tingling in my body. And I could feel like their mind was telling them, that's bad. There's something wrong.
Yes.
You need to fix it, right? And yes. So I jokingly said, well, people pay a lot of money for drugs to do that.
To
break the tension a little bit. Because we take whatever's happening in the body and we take it personally, meaning that we think it needs to get fixed or, that it's wrong and it's bad. In fact, when I ask people to feel things in their body and to share a description based on what the feeling is, we'll get people that say, oh, well, it's my depression. And I'm like, well, that's actually not a description of the feeling. Or,
exactly.
They'll say it's my hip, my hip arthritis. It's like, that's not it either, right? So we're so conditioned to label it as something bad instead of that curiosity.
Yeah.
So it's kind of buzzing.
Yeah.
So it's very liberating. I feel so much more peace now than I ever did because I was really a worry wart as a kid. I mean, I just worried about everything. And nowadays, if I start to do that, I just... that direct approach you talk about, for me, going through the body, maybe, sideways, not quite direct, but close to, I get there pretty quickly. It's super helpful. So the question is now, Kevin, is that, okay, people are going to say, okay, Dr. Kevin, what about, all these yogic traditions and Vipassana meditation and the, Buddhist, meditation and Qigong and, all these other things. Are you saying they're useless? Are you saying we shouldn't do those things? Or you mean your way is better than those ways? So how would you answer that?
Meditation is what we are. Meditation isn't something we do. As you stated, Dr. Karen, just when you were talking a little bit ago about I would try to sit and meditate, and there was a me trying to sit and do something, and it didn't work. And this is absolutely true because there's a great teacher there was a great teacher last century named John Klein, who said, when you sit to meditate, when there is a you sitting to meditate, it's like putting a donkey in a stall, and you can't get out of that stall because meditation is what you are. Meditation is your aware being. That the highest meditation is simply sitting and being aware, recognizing that you are awareness, what you've called I your entire life, and being aware of being aware. Now, that is the highest meditation. Having said that, it is anything that anyone is doing. I would never tell anyone to not do what it is they're doing. If they came and asked me, I would point out this direct path because to my mind, it's the easiest and the most simple and direct way to recognize what we are. But every mind is configured differently, and every mind is configured in a way that it seeks the ocean. The river is seeking the ocean in whatever way that river is kind of been engineered. And all our minds are like that, and they're different in a little different way. So what I generally say is that, it's just like we talked about with The Course in Miracles. There are some folks that will resonate with, and there's others that won't. But there are some that will resonate with that, and they will take that all the way. There's no question about that. That has certainly happened. So it's more of just, I think, the recognition that the time is right for this direct approach. It's something that I think we as a people right now, as a planet right now, are ready for and something that we need. So I'd never say something is better or worse. I would say that this is something that has worked for me, and I see why this is an approach that I think can be beneficial to most, not all, certainly not all at this point, but most people who are very interested or driven, that have that little willingness to say there must be a better way. There must be a better way.
I love that. And so just the simplicity of asking, am I aware? That's it? That's the direct approach?
If you ask yourself, am I aware? You could say, what is it that knows my experience? But if you ask yourself the simple question, so if one closes their eyes and asks themselves the simple question, am I aware? You will say yes, but the reason you will say yes is because you actually recognize experientially that awareness.
That is incredibly
powerful. It's that glimpse, that recognition of what you've called I your entire life. And from that point, it needs to be watered. You know, you need to abide as that over and over and over again. And the mind that has recognized that experience, that happiness and fulfillment can't be found in outward circumstances, will generally have the discipline to keep going back and abiding as that awareness. Mm. If the mind doesn't, that's fine. It simply means that the mind hasn't exhausted its search for peace and happiness in the only place it can't be found, in experience. But that is a search that has to be exhausted. You can't go and tell anyone, you know, to give that up. That has to be something that everyone comes to of their own. They have to come to that conclusion on their own. So in a sense, the real trick is, you know, what minds have in a sense the maturity or the burnout, if you will,
you know, from,
yes, from looking for experience. Yeah, in my case, it was suffering, anxiety, whatever, however it is for each individual. But yeah, that's how simple it is. And there's a very real reality that it's too simple for many minds, because the minds are still fixated on experience and the belief that the ultimate answers lie in some great experience, some great culmination of experience or something external, without the recognition that can never be the case, because everything that comes goes. Any experience, good or bad, that comes is going to go.
Yeah, that's beautifully said, and I think that's really good counsel as well, because there's so many of us that, of course, want to make a difference, so we are, you know, trying to say, hey, things like, for example, oh, guess what? You should really read this book, The Still Point. It's the best, right? To everyone, yeah. Whereas everyone's minds may not be at that place. If they're really comfortable where they are, you know, usually this is the case, they're really comfortable where they are, it doesn't matter how many things I suggest or things that I feel would be good for them. Like my family members, I used to dictate to them what they should or shouldn't eat and yada, yada, yada. And they never took me seriously, even though I was the one, yeah, the MD, right? So I just gave up that and amazingly worked on myself. And all of a sudden, they started changing. I was like, right. Whoa, how did that happen? And so I think that, you know, people will read your book and go, oh, my gosh, I Auntie Janie needs this, or so-and-so needs this, but it's possible they will not receive it because they're not, their mind is still kind of fixated into, they're not uncomfortable enough, let's just say.
I agree. No, I mean, that really is it. Now, you know, the one thing I certainly know in my life, and I've read some, you know, you'll read something and there you'll, you know, I've come back to text maybe 7-8 years later when this recognition was clear or was becoming clear, and those words meant something completely different. You know, it was like reading a different book, but there was, yes, value, I think, in reading things the first time through and then coming back to it, you know, years later, because the mind was in a different place. The mind had exhausted perhaps its hope that I could find the answers I was looking for in experience. So that's exactly right, what you said. And I also think that, you know, you mentioned this idea of you do the work, you are motivated to be peaceful and happy. You do the work on yourself, and there's then, without any implicit teaching, just by being, by living, others and those around you will sense something different. And they will gravitate to it. You know, they will be much more interested. At this point, it will have some sort of greater meaning for them, because we can't this is not something that you can get up and give speeches about and proselytize and bring someone over to this, you know, point of view. But you can live it. You can live it by being, you know, loving, peaceful, open, and recognizing that, you know, as you move through the world, the doing that happens needs to be needs to include the entire ecosystem and not just a separate individual. That's very alluring to people. You know, it's very alluring to minds. And this is a way of teaching. This is, you know, this is a way that, you know, much teaching, you know, gets done on this planet right now.
Right, just being. And
yes.
Yeah, just being. Well, and you know, right now there's a lot of disillusionment going on among people and a lot of things being revealed that were hidden for, gosh, probably decades, centuries, millennia, and none of, you know, not the least of which, there were some pretty prominent, let's just say, spiritual gurus, come to find out, you know, they were part of, you know, human trafficking, or they were rapists, or, you know, like these people that had millions of followers that loved them, you know, and so people, you know, in that space are like, what? You know, and so there's that feeling of betrayal that could happen. And what you're saying in the book is like, hey, you kind of like you are your own guru, right? anytime we look outside and look outside for that advice, it's not to say that's a good coach or mentor, you know, that's all good. But at the end of the day, we still have to do our work. We have to be 100% fully responsible for.
Yeah, there's one teacher. There's one single guru. There's one single teacher. That's the still point. That's aware being. That is your being. And it is absolutely true that if you have the opportunity to hear the right words from someone who's established in that truth, it can be incredibly, incredibly helpful. And it can be incredibly powerful, but it can be incredibly helpful. But the recognition is that you're only being pointed back to your very self, and as you abide in and as yourself, which has to be done anyway for this to be an experiential lived realization and understanding, that's the only answer. Because, you know, spiritual teachers, anyone can use beautiful words, and anyone can, you know, can speak about the truth or touch the heartstrings and whatnot, but, you know, are you living the understanding? Has it made, are you happy and peaceful and content? And has it made that, you know, that difference in your life? At the end of the day, that's really all we should be concerned about. Otherwise, we're just creating another philosophy and another set of words that aren't really going to solve the problem of separation and all of sequelae that is the fundamental issue with our planet at this time. So,
Yeah, agreed. Well, I'm going to ask you some questions that come from the book that I thought were very interesting. I really enjoyed the answers of it. And these are some of the questions that I hear as well that many people are interested in. So first question is about love. Where does love come in? We talked about the still point and, you know, that question, am I aware? But where does love come in? Because we hear that love cures all, love is the most powerful frequency, it's the highest vibration. So how does this all, like, connect with love? And is it really that important?
Love is when you have the experience of love with another person or an animal or a pet, it's because there's a recognition of self in the other. That's the experience of love. It's simply recognizing. It is that felt recognition of sameness in the other, and that's what we call love. You can say that love is the recognition of the still point of our being, our unified being, in relation to others, again, whether they be, you know, animals, humans. When we do this, when we have this recognition of the still point of our unified being in relation to objects of art, we call it, or music, we call it beauty. And when we have it in relation to thinking and to words, we call it truth. So truth, love, and beauty are really the recognition of the recognition within objective experience of this unity of being. That's the easiest way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sometimes we think, oh, well, you know, love is so great. You know, I love my grandchild, or I love my tribe, or, you know, I love this planet. And at the same time, there are elements that are in our current experience in the outside world that we do not like. So how is it that we could love, and is it mutually exclusive? For example, I can say truthfully that I love, you know, our president in the United States, but I can't say I like him. Does that make sense?
Of course it makes sense. And that's the reality with it all, being that you don't like everybody, but you, that love, love ultimately is something that must be there for all other, because there is the recognition of sameness. Liking is based on personalities. Liking is based on traits of the mind, of conditioning, of do we jive, do we have the same, you know, interests, and can we converse about the same things? It's completely different. We don't have to like everybody. We don't like everybody, but we do have to love them, because love is simply the recognition that beyond the conditioning, beyond all of the personality traits, beyond you know, the likes and dislikes and the judgments of the mind, the source of mind is the same, and we are all that. You know, what you call I is the same as what I call I. It's the same as if, you know, you can speak to anyone on the planet. It's the same I. So that's the difference between liking and loving.
Oh, that's so helpful. Now, this kind of goes into the next somewhat spicy question. I mean, it's not spicy for you, but spicy for many people, because they're very, very polarized on this topic. So, you know, I have friends who are, you know, doing a carnivore diet and have needed that for their health, other people doing vegetarianism, veganism, paleo, I mean, you name it, right, across the board. Sometimes I like to joke I'm in the seafood diet, meaning I see food and I eat it. So, however, I've played in these other realms as well. And so I think especially for my beautiful vegan friends, they are like, well, we can't solve the violence in this world if we are still killing animals and eating them. So it like totally turns them off, and totally get it. I empathize absolutely. And at the same time, as a medical doctor and holistic medical doctor, I've seen where people have really needed to eat meat for their well-being and recovery of their hormones and different kinds of things. And so here it is, that left brain, you know, the data, you know, of the experience. Am I open to the possibility that we could be nonviolent to everything? Yes, I clearly I'm not Buddhist, so I'm not there yet. And is that something to aspire to? Like, should we all eventually be vegan and not be, you know, harming animals, including the mosquito who's biting and sucking blood out of us? So what's your thoughts on that?
We should recognize that the root problem is the problem of separation. It's the problem of recognizing or believing that we are separate, isolated individuals. And if that problem isn't solved, if we do not solve that root issue, if we do not move away from the materialist perspective that is currently the dominating thought system of this planet, you can call it the ego mind, the materialist perspective, the separation, whatever you want to call it, we won't make much headway in any direction. That's the root problem. Anything other than that is simply projecting the problem onto a solution that will never be a solution. Mm. It simply will never work. And you know, as I think I say in the book, because there was, you know, questions, you know, asked about that, everything is the same substance. There is consciousness pure, and there is consciousness in movement or motion, and any experience, any object we have ever been involved with, any sight, any sound, any thought, can all be reduced to the consciousness that knows it. As a result of that, everything we see. This is why it's non-duality. It's all simply the movement of consciousness. And when we begin to make artificial distinctions, then we're into judgment, and judgment is in our function. I think I mentioned in the book that, you know, plants have sentience. Plants absolutely have sentience. They have a sentience, and they have a means of interacting with the world that is different than animals. But it's there. It's absolutely there and present. So, you know, it gets back to this, you know, this quote by St. Augustine where he says, "Love and do what you will." It can truly be said, "Love and eat what you will." First, recognize the unity of all, and then that will take care of everything, because what you do will be inclusive of all and of the bigger and the complete picture.
Oh, yes, yes. So again, you're pointing out that when we say, well, you know, we shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that, then we're really on the surface, not really the main issue, you know, underneath. We're seeing things as separate. And so, and in your book, you said it beautifully as well. It's like, well, where do you draw the line, right? Like you said, plants are sentient. So where do you draw the line? And you know, if someone who's, you know, feeling very good about being vegan, they're not killing animals, not eating them, seems really like very primal or whatever to them, it really turns them off, and at the same time might, I don't know, smack a bug on their body.
You mentioned that I live in the tropics here. It's the rainy season. I'll go out for a run. I'll come back with, you know, a thousand bugs dead on me. And, you know, there's no intention in that of doing anything, you know, like that. But this is just the reality. This is the reality of living. But the real issue is the issue of separation. And if we recognize our true nature as the true nature of all, then, you know, from that point, decisions flow from that place of love, and they're loving decisions. And, you know, this is not to say at all that there aren't practices out there that are not loving, whether they're to the animals of this, you know, of this planet or the environment. We know that all of that stems from the belief in separation. And if we don't cure the root issue, if we don't recognize and live from alleviating the belief in separation, we won't get far. We may solve one thing, but like everything else, we'll find another problem, another way to separate and to divide, because we are with the split mind. We're with the ego mind. So it won't ultimately work.
Yeah, it sounds to me like, you know, the trigger for us to kind of remember that we are that one awareness is if we start to get into, that's right, this is not right, or this is wrong, or this is bad, and then this is good. Yeah. I mean, it simplifies it, but I notice some of those thoughts, you know, going through my mind, and then I kind of pause and I need to sometimes go, huh, is that really true, Karen? You know?
Judgment's not our function. That's certainly a lot of the Course in Miracles, but it's absolutely true. We don't have the opportunity to see the entire movie or the picture of the entire movie. We get a little snapshot, a single scene, and then we want to go in and we want to say, you know, what's right or what's wrong, without being able to see any of the previous scenes or any of the, you know, the future scenes. And, you know, there's nothing ultimately that happens that's wrong or that's off. But from the limited perspective of the unreal belief in being, we're separate, isolated beings, that's what we do. You know, that's when that mind is in that, within that belief system, it judges, and it is constantly saying yes or no. It's, you know, trying to drop more pleasure to us and to push more pain away. We were continually operating in end gaining. We're continually operating in continual movement of the mind, and you know, again, attempting to ward off pain and attempting to get more pleasure. And this is not. It's simply something that, you know, that will not work. You got to jump off the wheel. You got to recognize that you are that, which doesn't come and go, and which knows or is the knower of all of the comings and goings. And until that point, and until jumping off the wheel, there'll always be judgment and resistance to a lesser or greater degree, and then there'll be, you know, consonant with that, there'll be suffering to a lesser or greater degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made a lot of sense there. Very, very clear. Now, one of the other questions I loved your answer to on page 180 was, what is addiction? Like, why are there so many people addicted to sugar or caffeine or alcohol or stress or work or, you know, and I've certainly had many myself, so mostly work, but what's that about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, ultimately, we get a taste of the still point, and then we relentlessly chase it over and over in experience. You know, and someone may have tried a substance, and that substance provided them a felt sense of peace, and you know, perhaps the mind dissolved for you know, the first time someone used something, it dissolved for a period of time, and that. That peace and contentment of our true nature was felt. So as opposed to recognizing that the reason for this was there was a period of being desireless, that you were without desire, you mistakenly give the object the you mistakenly refer to the object as what you know, what was the cause of that. The object is never the cause. It's the desirelessness we feel when we obtain something. And then when we continually go back to that object, it doesn't deliver that again. You know, it won't deliver that same level of peace that it did, because we're seeking in the wrong place. It's one of the classic upside down problems of this planet, in that we don't teach, you know, we'll go out and we'll desire, I don't know, say you're 16 years old and you desire your first car or whatever it is, and you get that car, and for a while you're happy with that. It's not because of the car, it's because you're desireless. The acquisition of that particular object was strong enough that your desire dropped away for a while. And when you're desireless, you're not in resistance to what is, and you're happy and you're peaceful. When that goes away, instead of recognizing that it was the desirelessness, we assume it was the object. So then we simply focus our attention on the next object. Let's try to get more. Let's try to get this. Let's try to get more. And it doesn't work.
Mhm. Mhm. So true. I do realize in the past I would buy a lot of things off Amazon and then go, "Why did I buy this?" Like I was trying to fill a hole, an emptiness or something.
Yeah.
And
we love new things, and there's a
shiny,
you know,
new
there's
things.
A shiny new things, but and there's a reason for that. That's because very often when we obtain something, that desire drops away for a little bit, and we're left in our globality. We're left in our totality. We're left in our true nature. And that is always peaceful and fulfilled and content.
Okay,
but
great. Well,
when we don't recognize that,
right.
We just simply go after more objects, more, you know, more. That's a fundamental problem of society. And of course, when you live in a consumer, you know, consumer-based economy, that's the message that everyone's getting from dusk to dawn, basically.
Right. Buy this, you'll feel better. Buy this, you'll be happy. Buy this, you'll have better relationships. Yeah, lots of messaging there. So one of the other questions that, again, came out of the book I thought was really good for us to discuss is about reincarnation and karma. So, you know, a lot of people are, this is not what I resonate with, but a lot of people be like, well, you know, those bad people, it's karma. Karma's a bitch, excuse the language, but, you know, karma's a bitch, you know, and all this kind of like, well, wait till they get their just deserts, you know, that kind of karma. And at one point when I was connecting with Source and having a conversation, you know, the message was, there is no karma. And I was like, excuse me, what? There is no karma. I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to be very popular sharing this message, but oh, well, you know. So some people say, well, you know, you got karma, so you got to reincarnate and reincarnate and reincarnate until you fix it. So what's your perspective on that?
Well, you know, I think I go through it in the book fairly, a couple questions or fairly extensively. And from the absolute point of view, awareness, which is whole and complete and is unified, all of the, you take the, you know, seven, eight, I don't know, however many billion people there are on the planet right now, these are all precipitations or contractions in the form of mind of the one single, the one awareness, this consciousness. And this consciousness is what we are. This is our true nature. And all of these various minds are essentially points of view with the opportunity to experience the inside of the mind of God. You can say if you'd like to put it this way. So in this absolute point of view, there are no bodies that are serially traveling through space and time. It's the model of reincarnation is very helpful, and it can be very helpful as a model. But from the standpoint of awareness, which is really what, you know, we're trying to recognize ourselves as that. There's no karma within. There's no thought within within awareness. Thought is for the mind. Thought and all experience are for the seemingly separate, contracted individual mind. So from one standpoint, when we talk about it from the standpoint of the absolute, it isn't helpful to talk about incarnation, or it isn't helpful to talk about reincarnation. From the standpoint of the relative mind, it can be a very helpful model, and a model that's been kind of well thought out. And I would simply say that while karma is ultimately karma, just like everything, you know, is ultimately not true. Not a single concept is true within the still point. From the relative perspective of the mind, there's a relative reality to it. You know, that simply action and reaction is something that you will see in the relative. You really can't. It's a very somewhat of a big topic, and something that would take a long time to really talk about. But from that standpoint, relatively, you know, we have to understand that there are things that that appear that we can label them, and they have a relative reality to that. So I would agree with you in the absolute when you recognize that at that level, of course, there is no karma. But from the level of the individual and the individual minds and the belief in individuality, then we see that you know, that action and that reaction you know, take place at time.
So cause and effect in our relative reality that exists. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean it's you know, as I mentioned in the book, it is impossible to understand the totality of a system and,
right,
you know, really explain a cause and effect in a satisfactory way. But we certainly, you know, we certainly do it, and we certainly try to do it relatively. I don't think we're very effective at it, frankly.
Yes, we keep putting that effort in. I do have one last question for you, Kevin, and that is around truth. So this word truth has been kicking around now a lot more in the last couple of years. Is there such a thing as absolute truth or absolute divine truth, or is that, you know, immutable, or is that, again, part of the relative?
Truth is the recognition of the still point in relation to thought. As I mentioned, where, you know, beauty is in relation to objects of art, love and recognition, the recognition of self in others. And the only ultimate truth, the only thing that can ultimately be verified is our self-aware being, which is the still point itself, because everything resolves into the still point. That is truth itself. And you know, a lot of, certainly you had mentioned love, but there are, you know, many people refer to the ultimate reality, which can be called many things, as I mentioned in the book, as truth or love or beauty or awareness or consciousness or God or the Tao. It can all go on and on, and it's all referring to the exact same recognition of being, of aware being.
Beautiful. Well, Kevin, it's been wonderful having you on the show today. And if people want to know more about you, where can they go online to find out more?
Yeah, there's a website, authorkevinkrinitsky.com. And, you know, certainly they can contact me through there. Any other questions? The book is available, you know, online everywhere for the most part, you know, either audiobook or, of course, hardcover right now. And, yeah, that's probably the easiest way.
Okay, great. So I'm just going to repeat that for everyone. It's authorkevinkrinitsky.com, spelled in all in one word, author, A-U-T-H-O-R, Kevin, K-E-V-I-N, and Krinitsky, KRENITSKY.com. And you can get a hold of Dr. Kevin that way. Dr. Kevin, I'm sure there's probably a bunch of people going, is he still practicing? Well, as an MD, probably not. But I'm sure you're having a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I don't. I haven't. I went into business after my residency and was more on the business end of medicine for 15 or 20 years. I keep an active license, but I certainly don't practice. I don't practice medicine.
Yeah. So there's we keep evolving, expanding, and same here. I retired. Interestingly, you know, got the intuitive hit to get out of my holistic acupuncture practice. I had very few patients at that point. I spent so much time with each of them, and that was God told me May of 2019, and I argued with God, and I said, no, I think I should do the full 2 years. I warned them about, you know, that I'd be closing the office, and that would make it November 2019, and God insisted May 19. And then certain things happened to really, like, basically kick me in the butt to go, May. Right, I'm like, okay, May it is. So I did May, right, and had no clue, not even a whiff, that the pandemic was going to happen, and it would have just been a mess had I waited.
Yeah.
So I'm just so grateful to have connected and got the right information for me, and I'm just, really, really grateful. So Dr. Kevin, again, fantastic having you on the show. Thank you for your beautiful book. Highly recommended, everyone. Get a copy of that and read it a number of times. That's what I would recommend. So bless you, Dr. Kevin. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. Bye for now.